Hello, everyone, all you beautiful people out there, all you lovely, lovely people. We're back with another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife. My name is Mason, and my pronouns are she, they.
My name's Jeremy, and my pronouns are he, him.
Sorry, I cut you off. You can say your pronouns.
And I'm Pedro, and my pronouns are he, him.
Very, very cool. So, our guest today is another person who is international. His name, like you said, is Pedro, and his pronouns are he, him, and he is from Puerto Rico, and he has come on the podcast today to chat with us about Puerto Rican history and Puerto Rico's contemporary position in relation to the United States.
That's correct. Yeah. Oh, hello, yeah. When it comes to Puerto Rico, it's kind of forgotten a lot of times, especially when it comes to talking about movements that are fighting for independence. They're mostly left. It's left out. And I'm not saying, oh, we're not important, but it's like we need to recognize it, too. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we have a lot of ground to cover today. So I figured we'd just get right into it. And in order to properly tell this story, we're going to be going back a couple hundred years, all the way back to the 1490s when Columbus first landed on Puerto Rico, then known as Boriken by the indigenous people. And to lead up to that, we are going to discuss what Puerto Rico, or Boriken, was like before the Spaniards and Columbus came. So, yeah, tell us about that, Pedro.
All right, let's get into it. Okay, so, like you said, before Columbus, before the evil Italians arrived in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, or Borinquen, or Borinquen, which means land of the brave in Taino, was essentially a society, but it was a type of developed society in the sense that the natives had a social structure. The natives had a type of hierarchical society, similar to Europe, in the sense that there was a chief, and then there was the peasant class. I'll get into the whys, because they were different, but I'm giving an example so you know how the society worked. On the island, an approximate population of natives was around 100,000. 100,000 natives lived in Puerto Rico, and that's an approximate. But basically, there were 19 chiefdoms, or cacicascos. All of them had their leaders, and basically, in each one, there was a society at work. Basically, each one, like I said, had their leader, a cacique, which was the person leading and had all the power of the Yucayeco, which was the town or the village. You had the Nitainos, the Boike. Nitainos goes after the other one. The Boike were like the doctors, teachers, because they would educate the young about their history through el areito, which was a ceremony, and they would also cure diseases with medicine, and they would use, it was a drug, but they would use it to communicate with the gods. And they would meet with the cacique and the Nitainos, which were like the noble class. I'll get into them right now, to communicate on what to do, the decisions on the chiefdom. Now, the Nitainos, like I said, were the noble class. They were also warriors, the people who delivered justice, and they also assigned the jobs. They were, essentially, since they were the warriors, they would be also selected to be cacique, because the position of cacique was hereditary. Basically, there would be an heir, but the heir would be I'm pretty sure it's the nephew of the cacique's sister. And it was supposed to be the oldest. If there was none, then Itaina would take the position. And obviously, last but not least, the working class, which was in Naboria. They basically worked the land and everything related to agriculture, fishing, also hunting. However, this wasn't like feudal Europe. They had some sort of freedom. It was a kind of like a communal town because they all worked the land and they would provide for the whole town. So it wasn't like they weren't providing for a single person, like a lord or something that would take most of it and leave them with nothing. It was all embedded in the community. And it said that each town or village could sustain itself because of the system. They worked and what they planted and what they caught would sustain them for a long time. If they couldn't get something, they would trade with the other tribes across the Caribbean. So yeah, that's kind of like the basic of what was Borinquen before the Spaniards.
Okay, so the caciques were basically the leaders of the village, and they did have a laboring class under them without the power and the privilege that the caciques had, but it wasn't necessarily the same type of relationship that a peasant had with their feudal lord over in Europe, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't an exploitative type of system. There was they obviously didn't have like the freedoms that we have now, but obviously they weren't, you could say, abused or even taken of everything if they didn't provide enough, because they were all doing it for the same thing, to help the community. So
that's really fascinating. Like I find that, like, when we look into societal structures prior to colonialism and prior to the imposition of, at the time, what was essentially feudalism or capitalism. I think during Christopher Columbus's time, that was like really the emergence of like mercantilism. But when we look back into how these people lived their lives prior to being invaded and being taken over for the profit of another group, you find a lot of diversity, and you find a lot of lifestyles which almost feel more in tune with human nature, in the sense where, like, in the sense where, like, we all naturally want to take care of each other. We all need food, water, and shelter. And in these traditional, like, communal societies, people's needs were met because these resources were in abundance, and the colonizers clearly recognized that, and they were able to use their resources in a way that sustained everybody.
Yeah, and now that you mention nature, something I forgot is that, unlike when the Europeans arrived, the Taino and their descendants were known to... most of their religion was based around nature itself. But apart from that, they would hunt. Obviously, they would hunt manatee and other sea creatures and stuff like that. But there's a difference. The Europeans hunted for sport, not for sustenance. The Taino, they hunted when they needed to. So it was like, for example, they wouldn't depopulate the entire area of a certain species. They would only do it as necessary. It's obvious that native groups, and not only in Puerto Rico, but in practically the entire New World, they had a preservation of their surroundings. They cared for it because it was their home, and they felt connected to it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for when it comes to, not that I'm an anarcho-primitivist, but I think there's a lot to be said when it comes to the topic of, like, trying to live our lives in accordance to what is best for the planet. Because, like, we see this all the time with fossil fuel extraction and, like, something like the ivory trade, for example, where you have to poach an elephant to get the tusks. Like, there's a lot of very profitable things that are just bad for the planet and bad for our societies. And it would be a lot more ideal if we could live our lives in a way where we are not actively pulling the rug out from under us and destroying everything.
Yeah, there needs to be preservation. If there's not, then this planet's is going to go to shit, essentially.
Yeah, definitely, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the profit incentive, capitalism, and all that. So, yeah, if we take the rug out of that, then maybe we have a chance to live, essentially.
Definitely, yeah. And another thing that I wanted to mention, and forgive me if you've already covered this, is that stuff like polyamory and polygamy were pretty much accepted in Taino society.
Well, it wasn't in Taino culture. Like, not every Taino could have, like, it was, let me rephrase it.
Okay.
The polyamorous stuff was mainly for the cacique. The cacique was the only person, if I'm not mistaken, that could have multiple wives. Now, the reason was like Europe, make alliances and other stuff. Yeah, it wasn't like, there wasn't that type of idea. But yeah, there were the wives and stuff like that, and he would have a favorite wife. And he would go there with her. So yeah, it's it wasn't that like that, but they still practice stuff like that.
It was about the art of the deal.
Exactly. Basically, it's like, yeah, they did it to make alliances and stuff like that. But I'm gonna mention one, and here's the thing: Taínos have good things and bad things. But yeah, obviously, I'm not gonna be race. But here's the thing: the difference between me and races is that just because they had one bad thing, I'm not gonna say they were literal savages. Like, no, because that's what they like to do. I say one bad thing, and it's like I can be racist. No, that's not the reason. Caciques, when they died, they would bury their favorite wife alive with them. Now, it's obviously fucked up. But like a lot of native cultures, they had one thing that was bad, but that doesn't demonize the entire group.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's important. That's important to understand. And for a lot of people out there, because it still happens to this day with various groups, examples like Palestine, that because they have one bad thing, we can justify entire genocide against them.
Yeah. And like,
so yeah, it's very,
I think like, when we look at history and we assess the character of certain societies, there's this tendency to take the one or two bad elements about their culture or the more harmful elements and to use that to brand everybody with like the same like brushstroke, basically, like paint everybody with the same brushstroke. But in reality, like, there has always been a lot of diverse thought on certain societal practices and cultural practices. And it's not like everybody was in agreement with every single ritual which happened within a given society, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's, again, it's the whole idea that not every society is perfect. And it's obvious. But that doesn't mean we have to literally kill them because of that difference. And it's sadly something that still happens to this day. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. And we're going to see that when the Spaniards arrive. Because the stuff they did, I'm not going to mention all of it. There are some stuff that they did that basically tells you everything you need to know what they wanted to do when they first arrived.
Oh, definitely. They saw dollar signs. Like, that's really that's what it comes down to. They saw an exploitable population of people who were less technologically advanced than they were, And they use that advantage to basically enslave them. And that gets into the first invasion of Boricum. Or Puerto Rico. Yeah. So initially it was Columbus that came, right?
Yeah. Yes, Columbus was the first person that arrived. However, popular to come, not popular belief. He arrived on his second trip. The first trip he arrived, I'm pretty sure it was the Bahamas and parts of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, if I'm not mistaken. So that's where he first arrived. In his second trip, he then came to Puerto Rico and basically founded the island as San Juan Bautista, which was the original name of the island that was given to the Spaniard, by the Spaniards, sorry.
Hmm.
Yeah. But when Columbus came, and I'm going to try and see if I have it in my notes. I'm just going to mention one thing because I have it saved. What he said. So he has a diary, which you can look up and you can search it. And it's the Diary of Columbus. And he basically details everything. That and the letter he sent to the King of Spain. Or Catalunya. No, Castile, sorry. Castile, the King of Castile. He basically sent that letter. And both of those in his diary and in the letter, you can see the language he uses. In the letter he sent to the king, he basically says that they can conquer them and use them as a workforce. And in his diary, he literally says the worst. And it tells you why the natives attacked them later on. Because a lot of people like to think that the natives attacked them with no reason. And that, yes, they did bad stuff, but it wasn't enough to, like, you know, justify them attacking them. But what Columbus writes, literally the minute they arrive to the New World, they literally capture native people that were on a canoe. Like, they were just minding their own business. And then they get snatched by these people. Like, it's nothing. And they keep them captive. So they tell them, you're going to show us around. They couldn't understand them. But it's like they wanted them to show. Spaniard wanted them to show them the place. And it's kind of fucked up because the first thing they did was already, number one, they kidnapped people. The second thing they did, which was also horrible, everything was horrible, but like once they arrived proper and landed and started setting up stuff, they met with the people, like the leader. Already Columbus was talking shit about them, racist stuff. That's where you get the famous, I'm pretty sure it's from the diary, where you get the famous quote that the native grabbed the sword by the side that could cut, and the native cut themselves. That's a very famous one because it basically is used as that, like, they knew that they were inferior, but maybe the native just didn't know. Like, we're not going to assume that they were dumb because of that, and it's dumb to make that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that Columbus then, like, I think some days passed, and there was a native girl. And again, it's just horrible. The language he uses is, they describe, especially the women, they describe them as objects. They describe, like, this what's the word? Like, fetishism. I can't say the word. Exactly. And you see it clearly when they're talking about the females. And he goes into detail on, because he gave this woman to one of his first officers, I'm pretty sure. And this man, he wanted to have his way with her. And she didn't want to. So he beat her up to the point that she was unconscious and had her way. He had his way with her.
Jeez.
Like, yeah, no. And it's very grotesque because it's like, it's horrible. Because it's like, from the very beginning, they arrive. Their intentions of being peaceful are not there. They want to make it seem like, especially history nowadays, and conservative history, they want to make it seem like Columbus was the good guy and what they did was good. And that they had peaceful ambitions, even if they did some bad stuff. That's a lie.
Yeah.
They, from the very beginning, had ambitions to conquer. Because remember, the trip was, the idea of the trip was to find a route to India. Mm-hmm. So there, the population on that ship were obviously either mercenaries or people that were getting paid to basically do this type of trip where it would be dangerous and they needed backup. So these are the type of people that arrived. Mm-hmm. They had the intention of to kill and to loot, because that's where they came for. And it's fucked up because later down the line, they get mad. Like the sailors that went with Columbus, they get mad. But you want to know why they get mad? They get mad because Columbus was going fucking crazy and he started executing some of his men.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he started executing. By the way, that's the reason Columbus later, down his fourth and fifth trip to the New World, he gets his titles taken away and stuff like that by the Spanish crown, because he started killing Spaniards because he was going crazy with power.
I see.
Yeah, but nothing about the natives. Only him killing Spaniards was the tipping point. But yeah. It basically shows, the reason they were able to do this stuff is from the very beginning, they showed no mercy. They didn't consider these people human. And because they dehumanized them and they didn't consider them as human, it made it easier for them. Because I don't know, I try to put myself, because I remember when I was in a college class and we were talking about the Diary of Columbus and all that. And I remember, I tried to put myself in the shoes of one of these people. And just the idea of, because, and I'm going to give a trigger warning, a real quick trigger warning, because I'm going to say a detail that I read. And it was a detail of a Spaniard taking a baby and essentially bashing it.
Jeez.
And I tried to put myself in the shoes. And I'm like, how can somebody do this? How can somebody take something so small, a child, and throw it around like that? It doesn't make sense to me. And it horrified me. Because it showed you what these people were capable of and what they wanted. And that because they dehumanized them, because they considered them as savages, it made it okay for them to kill them without mercy, because they don't have a god, they don't have a language that we can understand, that they're just inferior. That makes it justifiable, and that's how they did. That's how they were able to conquer Boddington and the rest of the Caribbean and the rest of the New World entirely. They had no moral compass when it came to the natives.
Yeah. And, just a few things that I want to point out, because what you just said provoked these thoughts. Something I've been trying to learn more about recently is that patriarchy is a driving force in human history. It has been for, over 1,000 years now, I think. And when they went to these new lands, they had these ideas in their heads of adventure and conquer and plunder and taking the women as part of what is right. I mean, not rightfully, but in their minds, rightfully theirs. And the fetishization and dehumanization of women from Boricán and also Cuba and Haiti and really all of the global South today is part and parcel with the exploitation and profiting off of the people there. And another thing I just want to mention is that I feel like with your example of what they did to that baby, this is kind of just something that happens when you give people power over other people. I remember I was doing research into the Cold Wars for our Cold War series. Check that out. And there are all these stories of soldiers going into, or National Guardsmen going into people's houses and literally dangling the children by their ankles to terrify and instill fear in the people living in those houses, who were living in those houses, who they wanted to evict. And it's just a thing where you set up this relationship where there are people who are being exploited and people who are responsible for enforcing the rule of the exploiter, and the people enforcing the rule of the exploiter often do really horrible things to the people who are being exploited.
Definitely. When you give, I mean, again, like it's happening in Palestine.
Yeah.
If you dehumanize and make the supposed enemy look like it's inferior, then anything goes by their head as okay.
Yeah.
From rape, murder. Side note, because you mentioned a patriarchy and men's role in how they perceive women, especially Native women, I wanted to mention a story. I don't remember her name, but there was a woman, a Native woman, because later down the line, when the Spaniards began to do the tactic, which was the what they did in the other parts of the New World, which was trying to marry into the positions of power to take over. There was one case where a Spaniard was able to become a cacique, pretty much by force. But his wife was a Native woman. And this woman was able to kill her husband, which was the Spaniard, and she became the first, like, woman cacique.
This is how women win. Like,
yeah,
this is just what has to be. This is what you gotta do, you know.
Yeah, we need more women to unshackle themselves. Like, don't dare to lose. You have nothing to lose, especially when the abuser is right there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but yeah, but continue on the conquest, because I want to make it short because there's a lot, mm-hmm. and we can be hours talking about, like, how they were able to do it and what they did from account from Columbus to Bartolomé de las Casas. But I'm going to keep it a little bit short. Bartolomé de las Casas was one of those first people that was a friar, who, not a friar, like a religious person. He wasn't literally a friar. But basically, he documented all the stuff that happened. And the reason we know a lot about this stuff is because of him. One of the baby one I said came from him, from the brief retelling of the destruction of the Indies. And one of the things he mentions there is the population number. Now, I said before that apparently there were like 100,000 natives in Puerto Rico. Now, he mentions in a very short paragraph, because he wasn't in Puerto Rico for a long time, but he mentions how from 100,000, well, he mentions 600,000, apparently, that they were in Puerto Rico. And I'm pretty sure in, I think it was either the Dominican Republic or Jamaica, I'm not sure. But he mentions that from 600,000, there were only about 200 natives left on the island.
Holy shit.
No, yeah. And even if those numbers are real, or if the 100,000 one is real, it's incredible and horrifying to see that from a population of about 500,000, almost none of them were left. And it shows you the brutality, because not only did they die by the Spaniards' hand, they died by disease as well, and hard work, because the Spanish made them work as slaves in the mines.
Yeah.
So it shows you the brutality. They did not care. Like, there was a story Bartolomé said about a Spanish, he was a military leader. He was leading, because this was around 1500s, like after like Columbus and all that stuff. Like, around 1500s is when Puerto Rico starts to become like this type of settlement for the Spanish, when they start building their empire in the world. So he tells that the Spaniard, he would get 200 natives, right? Yeah. And they would work the land. And most of these natives would die in about 3 months. And he would be left with like 20 of them.
Wow.
So yeah, they would force them to their deaths. They would work them to death, because that was the point of it. And the only reason this changed the reason this changed is because they passed a law in the Spanish courts, the whole story with the queen defending native rights. And thanks to Bartolomé, this happened, where they basically abolished native slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did they do? Instead of natives, they replaced them with Africans.
Yeah.
And they didn't really abolish it. What they did was they brought the encomienda system to the majority of the New World, which is essentially a type of feudal system where, like I said, they didn't have to work for a lord. But with the encomiendas, they had to work for a lord. And they would be getting paid. But in order for not to be slavery, what they did was in the encomienda system, they would literally pay them with stuff, like with food and with clothes, like with like shit clothes and not good stuff. They would pay them in that way. So it's like, oh, so they can say, oh, but it's not slavery because I'm paying them in a way. But that's how they basically did it. They would still work. The natives would still work, and the Africans would work, or better not work. They would be forced to work as slaves in other parts of the island.
Yeah, and this importation of like Africans was something that would go on for hundreds of years. It took a long time before the slave trade was abolished, and when they did abolish the slave trade, it was really more of a business decision, because by that time they had already had a massive infusion of free labor. From the slave trade, and it actually got to a point where capitalism was developing in a direction in which slavery actually got in the way of business. It got in the way of local exports. Just like, it makes more sense to leave the people in the country where they already are and have them harvest resources from that country for your little imperialist scheme. So, like, by the time they ended slavery, like, the damage had already been done, and more damage would be done to the African continent. But we're not really here to talk about the African slave trade. We're here to talk about Puerto Rico.
I want to mention one last thing, because I want to mention this. The native population of Taino did rebel in 1511 to 1518. They did rebel. They fought back. And the reason that number from 600,000 went down so fast is because, remember, they were fighting as well as suffering from starvation and other stuff. Yeah. They were fighting. And there are myths. They like to propagate myths that the natives thought that they were gods. The Spaniards were gods. They were not gods. They didn't have to drown a Spaniard in order to believe that they were not gods. They already knew because they had killed Spaniards before. They communicated with each other. But the natives did fight back. And this is not really taught in Puerto Rico. Like, you can look at a book and it's going to say, like, oh, like, they won't mention the rebellion at all, or they'll mention that it was crushed in, like, 2 days or something. Because they're trying to hide that, because it's an independent, it's a revolutionary movement, it's a national movement. It's something that can cause people to think, we need to fight for our freedom, so they suppress it. So, yeah, I just wanted to mention that real quick before we get on to the next question.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And, like, I think it's very important to dispel that myth that the Spanish had the people of Puerto Rico just entirely tricked. Because if you're operating under this assumption, you're basically operating under the assumption that, like, the Spanish were just smarter and superior to the people of Puerto Rico, and that wasn't the case.
Basically, that's the myth. The whole they were gods is basically that. Like, who else but the Europeans to tell that they arrived to this place that nobody knew about them, and all of a sudden they think they're gods? Like, it's the same thing.
Yeah,
it's like white supremacy and the idea that we are superior, so we have to be gods. But they probably didn't think that. They probably just thought, like, who are these white boys on our coast?
Why are these weird guys with swords suddenly in my nice little village?
For you, like, what is this, they are burning up in the beach.
They'll be too busy tending their sunburns to really do colonialism. It's okay.
But the only the Europeans can go to a place and consider themselves superior without taking into account what the people did.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about the early history. Just to kind of recap. So the Spanish crown invaded in 1493, led by Juan Ponce de León. And then Ponce de León became the governor of Boricán. He became a top-ranking military official in Hispaniola, which referred to Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And there he was tasked with crushing this Taino rebellion. And then afterwards, he led the initial colonial invasion of Boricán by the Spanish in 1508. He became rich off of the enslavement of the Taino people, who were forced to work in the fields and mines. And every Taino above the age of 14 was forced to pay gold to the Spanish crown every couple of months. In 1511, Ponce lost the title of governor to the son of Christopher Columbus and decided to colonize the Caribbean because he was apparently a little upset and needed to ruin some more lives. And then later on, slavery was introduced. So they needed to replenish the workforce that they had because many Tainos had been killed. So they decided to import slaves. In 1511, there was a Taino rebellion that lasted until 1518. And in 1527, the first major slave rebellion took place. A few slaves escaped to the hills with the remaining Taino people.
I'd actually like to jump back to the to Ponce de León and Columbus's son becoming the quote-unquote governor.
Yeah.
Now, I assume that was a fair and balanced election that happened.
It was fair indeed. You know, Juan Ponce de León got 99% of the vote, you know. He got elected. You know, the only ones that didn't vote are the ones that, you know, the people that don't like voting, because everyone else voted. All the 4,000 people that could read and write.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have heard that. So, I assume, in all seriousness, that Ponce de León took the governorship by military force.
Not by military force. Before he came to power, there were other people in charge. They had a specific seat where you would be in charge of, like, colonizing the island for 2 years, and for 2 years you had that position, and there were other people, and like you mentioned, the Columbus or not Columbus what was it Columbus I think it was he offered Juan Ponce de León, if I'm not mistaken, the position.
So he was literally just appointed.
He was appointed because I'm pretty sure Columbus' son became like the one in charge of the entire like Caribbean region, if I'm not mistaken, because again I've not read too much into these parts, because it's a little bit complicated, because it's a lot of people just taking and stealing stuff. It's like, it's basically that, but the point is, he got the governorship, he became like the first governor, and he was the one that, you know, did some horrible shit. He started the encomienda system, he distributed slaves. He partitioned the island between two parties that govern, San Germán, one part of the island, and the other one was, I forgot the other name, but he divided the island in two. And in that division, The only thing he did that is worth noteworthy of, like, you know, like, something he did is that he removed the capital from one part, which was a literal swamp, and moved it to where it is now, which is San Juan, which is like an isleta, an island that they had to connect. And he then got bored because he didn't like moving into San Juan. He thought it was a bad idea. He didn't like it, but the people did. And he left to Florida to die off somewhere because he was looking for the so-called fountain of youth, whatever. Yeah, whatever he was looking. He was probably high on drugs and he wanted an excuse to fucking leave or to kill more people.
It's so funny that he thought there was like just a pool of water somewhere that would make him immortal.
He died of old age, goes looking for the fountain of youth, dies of old age.
Maybe he found it, yeah. But it was actually the fountain of aging. He got the wrong one.
He went to the beach that makes you old with Ben Shapiro.
Went to Miami. Oh god. But yeah, basically that's the process. I didn't mention it because it's a very tedious process to talk about. But yeah, it's kind of like what happened. But yeah, he basically did colonize the island and he was the one in charge of it. But during that whole process, like, the island started to develop into what is, like, a colonial Puerto Rico. Because by that point, Puerto Rico was practically the name they were using. And the literal reason why it was called Puerto Rico was because of Rich Port, which is the literal translation of Puerto Rico into English. So it was rich because there was a lot of gold. And it was a port because when they had moved to San Juan, that was the main port.
It's like if the Brits went and colonized somewhere and they called it loads of money.
Yeah, it's like they didn't have any imagination. Like, they colonized and they killed and they pillaged, and even then they didn't even have any imagination to name it something else. Yeah.
I mean, that's like what imperialism is. They're taking other people's imagination. Exactly.
For real. But yeah, that's pretty much what happened in that time.
Yeah. And I wanted to say on the subject of slavery, so during the periods from 1527 until slavery was abolished by the Spanish National Assembly in 1873, it's not like they were just complicit in their exploitation. There were at least 20 slave revolts during that period of time. Yes. So when we discuss, like, colonialism and all of its horrors, a big part of understanding that history is understanding the resistance against it that was mounted by the local peoples, even though they were confronting technological superiority and systems which were significantly better equipped and armed than they were. They were still fighting back, and I think that's very commendable.
Yeah. And again, it's not mentioned, most of this stuff. I mean, it's mentioned, but they try to sweeten it, because it's most about now, when it comes to anything related to fighting back or independence, they like to lie about it. Because they don't want kids to learn that, you know, that independence is good, or that people fight back against, you know, the oppressor and stuff like that. And that's something that happens to this day. So, because a lot of these, like, slave revolts, I probably heard them in school. But again, they're not put that much interest into it. Like, you don't learn in detail of what happened. You just learn that there were slave revolts, and that's it.
Yeah. Like, they don't want to give you a blueprint for, like,
yeah,
doing that yourself, like, basically.
Yeah, like, and again, like, in order for a Puerto Rican, and I mean this in general, to understand their history and to become somebody who supports independence, you need to do it by yourself. Everything on this island has been made to suppress the idea of independence. And I'm going off topic a bit.
No, please go.
But I'm mentioning it because, yeah, but the reason I'm mentioning it is because, again, similar to the slave revolts, they try to suppress the ideas that one can get, because similar to the slaves, that they got the ideas of freedom because of their exploitation, and they pass the voice to other people to free themselves. Similar, it happens to us too, that we are not taught our history, and the reason is because the United States won't allow that. And to become an independent supporter and to understand the true history of Puerto Rico, you need to teach yourself, essentially. There's no other way. Like, I had to do that, and many others have had to do that, and hit themselves in the wall to understand our true history and what we are capable of as a people.
Exactly, yeah. I really love that point, because, like, class consciousness, and just to define that real quick, class consciousness is basically what happens when a bunch of people within the same class become aware of their own interests and what is good for them. Class consciousness grows. When you
become woke.
People become woke.
Become woke, and then use pronouns, and like, what else do people that are woke
like? They like dyeing their hair, they like Mitski, they like all these silly new pop singers. But yeah, like, how class consciousness forms is, part of it is learning your own history, but part of it too is just discussing things with people who are living in similar conditions to what you're living in. And when you have this historical context, and when you have the context of the modern day, it becomes a lot easier to start to plan a path forward, and to start to stand in solidarity with the independence movements, the anti-capitalist movements.
Yeah. If you understand who you are, where you come from, and everything that happens around you, it's much easier. It's pretty much that. I supported independence, and then I became a communist because of it. Like, one thing leads to the other. Like, you can't just look at your entire history and not think that the problem is capitalism, because a lot of the reasons we are here now are mainly because of capital and profit and imperialism. So yeah, one thing leads to the other one, and people are going down that path. You end up being anti-capitalist by the end that you research your own history.
Yeah, definitely.
Looking at the history of colonized nations, as opposed to, like, the modern history of what's happening in, say, Palestine, for example, is really interesting, too, because the way that they cover up and prevent sort of class consciousness from forming in other places with an older history of it is to just not teach the history, like you said, or try to erase it from the public eye, whereas in Palestine, it's happening in real time, so the tactics they're using are, I wouldn't say they're good, but they're evolving. They're, like, people still can see the cracks, which is probably something they don't want, but it's a process, and it's an interesting process to see, as sad as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad, but at the same time, we're able to see what's happening, and, like, the cracks start forming, and as we've seen, people start to understand that we've been lied to. And I hope more people understand that, not only with Palestine, but with every single oppressed people in the world, that, you know, it's not what they tell you. There's more to it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the people living there always know that. It's the people in the periphery that don't.
People who I know who are Palestinian and have family back in Palestine see the situation with very clear eyes. Even Palestinians who are not considering themselves communists are very anti-colonial. They are against what the American Empire is doing to their people. And I think that, like, when you have that lived experience, or you have people in your life who have that lived experience, and you have this connection to it, it becomes a lot easier to see, like, okay, like, this is what is causing the people that I love to be living in such horrible condition. And that's the first step towards solving the problem, is identifying it. And I, like, I've talked about this before, but I am always very impressed and moved by the strength and the determination of the Palestinian people and the members of the Palestinian diaspora who are in my life.
Yeah, the Palestinians are very strong. They every time they don't give up, and I'm proud of them, and you know, all solidarity with them, and Puerto Rican solidarity, because we, like, the colonial struggle goes hand in hand with every people there, and we have shown solidarity with them, and they deserve our entire support, because they are fighting a war. Well, it's not even a war, it's a genocide. It's a genocide, and they deserve every support they can get, so they are not forgotten.
Yeah. And I don't think they're being forgotten. Like, we're recording this on the 12th. Tomorrow, there's going to be a massive march on Washington, which was organized, is being organized by a coalition of different left-wing groups and different Muslim American groups. And I think that, like, so long as this is going on, there will be resistance against it. Just like there was resistance against the Spanish when they came to Boricán, just like there is resistance today against the Americans and their contemporary position as the global superpower, which is colonizing not only Palestine, but also continues to keep Puerto Rico colonized and continues to keep many places throughout the world under their thumbs for the purpose of extracting resources and extracting a profit.
Yeah, definitely. And same way I hope that I am alive to see a free Palestine, the same way I hope to see one day a free Puerto Rico, where Puerto Ricans can decide their own fate without having the U.S. under their watching over it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So this has been a wonderful conversation. I think we went to a lot of really cool places with it, and we talked about a lot of very important things. So in order to end off this episode, I want you to talk about the Spanish-American War and its consequences.
Okay. So a lot of Americans and people listening probably know the Spanish-American War as that war that the United States fought with Spain. Because I don't know, what are you usually told about it? If you can give me a
context. The U.S.
Interesting anecdote here. If you look at a high school American textbook, the Spanish-American War probably total takes up maybe two paragraphs.
Yeah.
We're not taught very much about it in public school at all. So whatever Mason has to say probably came from her own research.
Yeah. Well, like, I know a little bit about it, and I know some of the immediate consequences. But basically what I was taught in school was the USS Maine was blown up under mysterious circumstances. Like, even as a kid, that set off some, like, alarm bells in my head. And then we went to war with Spain, and I think the part that they left out was we won a bunch of territory because of it. So I have it written in my notes. There was the 1898 Treaty of Paris between Spain and the Americans. And that relinquished control of Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain to the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, both of those anecdotes match with mine. Because, again, what you're taught is what we're taught. And that's pretty much the same, that the United States went to war because of the Maine, and they got Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines and Guam. That's the usual story. However, the Spanish-American War has context, like every other war. Mm-hmm. There's context, there's interest, capital interest and other stuff. And the United States had always been interested in Cuba. Now, there are various good books where you can read about this. Like, there's one book I'm going to recommend, which is How to Hide an Empire, The Greater Extent of the United States. I don't remember the author's name, but it's a good book because it tells you, like, some of the context of what the United States did with its Spanish new colonies. And obviously, I'm going to plug this one too, the Blowback podcast on Cuba. Also gives insight onto what the United States wanted Cuba. Mm-hmm. And the reason they wanted it is because of sugar. The United States wanted Cuba because it was practically the largest sugar colony in the entire Caribbean. Yeah. And they wanted Cuba. Now, it's very funny that they wanted Cuba. They had already gone to Spain to buy it, but the Spanish refused. And all of a sudden, a boat, a United States military vessel, explodes in Havana. It's a very, either a big coincidence or not, that this all happens. But yeah, it basically happens. And then there's these, the war begins. And then there's this, well, let me see, where is it? Because I have some quotes here from various, like, news agencies at the time, like newspapers. For example, there's one that says from the New York Times that says that they recognize the commercial valor of Puerto Rico, and it is wise to take it and keep it forever. Then the Times writes, the island is an enchanting place to spend the winter, and an excellent position from in between two continents, and it's an island that's worthy of having. Mm. And then there's this dude called Rudyard Kipling, which says that it's the white man's burden. And then the Times concludes that it's necessary to use it as a base of operation for the Grand Archipelago of America, and that we are not obligated to give the United States its independence, and that it would be better for us to take it and basically govern it, because they have no way of governing, because they can't govern for themselves. And by the way, this is like a book. This is the book War Against All Puerto Ricans. And these are quotes from like newspapers at the time saying what they should, the United States should do with Puerto Rico. I'm looking for another quote, and I'm giving you this as context. The United States published in the 21 of July of 1898, they published in its press a letter that said, Puerto Rico will be ours forever. Once taken, it will never be free. It will always be on the hands of the United States.
Wow. It's so fascinating hearing the discourse surrounding this island at the time, because some of it just sounds like ads for tourists. Like, some of it is just like this beautiful island with these beaches that you can chill out on and have a mimosa on. And other stuff is literally just like, yeah, we're going to take this. We're going to use it for our own purposes. Fuck the people there. We're going to keep it forever.
Yeah. And I mean, that still happens in the sense that how people talk about Puerto Rico. Because I don't know if you've gone on YouTube. If you search for Puerto Rico on YouTube, you get a lot of videos talking about the island and stuff like that. Most of them are Americans. But one of the things they like to mention is, here's a place that you can travel, and you don't need to have a passport for it, because it's part of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's like they try to evade this whole idea of, okay, why the fuck does the United States have this? Because it's like, okay, so you're trying to promote this place as a place where you can go, because if you can't go to anywhere else, you can go there because it's U.S. territory. You're an American citizen. But it's like it's the same language. Again, the language is one of the biggest problems, because they talk about it like it's, number one, there's a place that you can go and that there's no people there. And even when they go, they just stay in one part. They stay in San Juan. They don't go anywhere else. They just stay in the goddamn capital city. So if you're going to at least come, go somewhere else. Because, Jesus Christ, there's so many white people in goddamn San Juan.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this the other night, I think. And yeah. When you feel like you go... When you go there, you feel like you're not even in your own country anymore, yeah. Right?
It's like I'm a stranger because there's so many... I mean, there's various tourists, but the majority of them are American. It's like, and they come, and it's like I feel like a stranger. Because it's like, I get that the economy has shifted to tourism, but that's one of the biggest issues. By going to tourism, you are incentivizing certain operations that obviously are going to affect the local population. Mm-hmm. And one of those is that San Juan is not San Juan. I remember when I went as a kid, and I remember that it was much more prettier. I have nostalgia of that old San Juan, and it's gone because it's literally not the same. Prices have gone up. It's more of a tourist place now. It's always been a tourist place, but now it's even more of it. Certain stuff, like, for example, there was a beautiful mural in San Juan, which was dedicated to the... It was painted by some people because of the 2019 marches against the governor, Ricardo Rosselló. And they painted it to commemorate that moment. And they, like a few days ago, like a month, I want to say a month ago, they painted that whole wall purple and built a Ferris wheel there to attract tourists.
I hate that.
And they destroyed that entire mural. And that's the problem. They are destroying and taking away certain historical stuff because they want to paint a nice narrative to the Americans coming.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to scare them with this idea of why are they hating us? Because a lot of these goddamn Americans come. Like, I remember a fucking video of an American, like two Americans, and it's two white guys, by the way. They come in and they take a picture with like graffiti that says, "Go home, gringo," and they take a photo of it. Like, but they do a selfie. It's like they're making fun of us in a way. Yeah, and it's like that's the problem. They want to paint a picture that Puerto Rico is a place that you can come. And you can come. The problem is it's heavily reliant on this tourist industry. And the tourist industry is going to do everything in its power to make sure that, you know, it caters to them, not us. Like, for example, like one of the, like this was back in 2022, I think. Or 2023, I'm not sure. There was an ad by the tourist industry, like the tourist company here in Puerto Rico. And they put up, like, I think it was the word, you know what? If I can, I'm going to look it up so I can send it to both of you. But it's basically a photo of three people, two are children, and one is a female, an adult female. But here's the problem. It says the word Boricua. Boricua is the word that we use to refer to ourselves as Puerto Ricans. It's another word derived from the name Borinquen. Now, here's the problem. That photo of them is white. They're white. And here's the problem. It's implying that apparently Boricua people, or Puerto Ricans, are white. And it left a bad taste because they're trying to cater to these people as a sense that, like, that we're white, that this is a place for them to come, that we don't exist. It gives off bad messages. And so, yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a consequence of the initial colonialism, right? Spoiler for the next time you're on where we talk about sort of the comparison between Puerto Rico and Cuba, but Havana was... designed from the ground up to be a tourist destination for Americans before the revolution, where it was just full of brothels and restaurants and casinos.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah, there's a good comparison between Cuba and Puerto Rico because it gives you the example. Because one was like a U.S. protectorate or basically like a colony. It was a colony, but not like Puerto Rico's situation. So, like, there's a good comparison to make between both of them. in where one was able to was more developed in that sense, while in the other one it was like more so like a slow process. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna send a picture because I want you to see it real quick.
Oh god, that's horrible. They're fucking blonde too. Holy shit.
Where's the picture? Oh, it's in general.
Yeah.
It's in general.
Oh my god.
And it says live, I don't know, I'm pretty sure it says live Boricua. And if you put it that way, it's trying to say, so these are Puerto Rican. And it left a bad, when they published that, a lot of people got pissed. Because it was like, what are you trying to say? Because Boricua means Puerto Rican. Are you trying to say that those are Puerto Ricans? Because let me tell you something, there aren't a lot of white Puerto Ricans. Like, we fall under the name of white, but it mainly a lot of people here are mixed. So yeah, it left a very bad taste when that first unveiled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, this looks like the first time these people have ever even been on a beach.
If you look closely, you can see how burnt they are. Oh god, that's, by the way, unrelated, but that's so fucking funny. Because when I go, I'll usually see white people, and it's like, they're burnt the fuck up, they're red. And it's like, it's funny, because it's literally all I see every single time. It's like, these people just want to burn up.
Yeah, you can watch their skin turning pink as they walk towards you.
Yeah. If you don't mind, can we go back to the Spanish-American War? I think I derailed it enough.
Yeah. So, getting back to the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, so basically, once the United States took over Puerto Rico, the first thing that they did, they are so nice, the first thing they did is they put an entire fleet of ships, I don't know what you call them, I'm not a military, they're battleships, vessels, whatever, in front of San Juan, and they basically, I'm not sure, did they fire more than one shot? Because I know that they fired once. They started firing on San Juan, which, by the way, is a city full of civilians. They begun firing on it, and they invaded from the south as well. When they entered, unlike Cuba, where there were rebels, in Puerto Rico, a lot of people wanted the Americans to come, because a lot of people, especially intellectuals, thought that the Americans were going to bring democracy and freedom. They really thought that. And they supported the United States. Like, a lot of political parties that wanted independence from Spain actually supported the United States invasion, because they thought, you know, the United States would bring them some form of autonomy. How wrong they were, because immediately after the United States showed its real colors, most of these people turned to independence from the United States. But the Spanish-American War, the consequences, the big ones, was the transference of power. And essentially what was the only time Puerto Rico was about to get its autonomy, it was crushed, because before the invasion, the Spanish government had decided to give Puerto Rico autonomy, not out of goodwill. It was mainly influenced by certain events like revolutionary movements that the Spanish Empire had practically died. It was in disrepair, and it was basically about to die, so they decided to do this as a move, because Cuba was literally fighting a rebellion. So they said, in order to not lose Puerto Rico, we're going to give them something. So they were going to give them like a type of autonomy where we would have our own type like Senate or Parliament, I think it was, and we were going to have elected officials that we would be able to elect. We would have our own dollar, but we couldn't choose our own government. That was still on Spain. But it was something, it was close, and we were very close to getting it. 6 months pass, and I think the elections had happened, and then the United States invaded. And that government didn't even last, like, I'm pretty sure it didn't even last, like, 1 month. Because by 1898, when the United States had, the war had finished, they dissolved the government entirely. And it's that, by the way, they stopped, and then the United States established a military dictatorship on Puerto Ricans. So yeah, obviously any form of autonomy or governance by ourselves was quickly destroyed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 1900 that we had a civilian government. quotations, because that civilian government was composed by Americans and Puerto Ricans. But the Americans had more power over the Puerto Ricans, and the governor was elected by the president. So we didn't have our autonomy. We were ruled by the United States in every way. Like, we didn't have a say in it. And then comes good old American capitalism, because one of the first things the United States did is, once they got Cuba, they decided to also do stuff in Puerto Rico. So they began to basically buy up land and basically outsell landowners. And a lot of Puerto Rico's land went to a monoculture society where you only sugar was cultivated. Yeah. Well, it was the main crop. There were others, but sugar was practically all that was cultivated. And this helped in the United and sorry, in Puerto Rico's underdevelopment, because our entire agricultural and arable land that was able to be used for culture cultivation was used for a plant that wasn't edible or any other way. It wasn't something that could be, you know, done for good. So all that land was lost to sugar and all that stuff. And that was another consequence. Our agriculture basically became deteriorated because it went to one thing.
Yeah, and this is a process that's happened all throughout South America, really, is that prior to the imposition of colonialism and capitalism, there was actually a pretty major diversity in crops. And this made it so the soil was still, like, good enough to support the people living there. And it's just a lot healthier for soil in general to plant a diverse array of crops instead of just this, like, sugar monoculture. But
For people who don't know, different plants use different nutrients, so cycling through them keeps the nutrients in the soil, rotated, I guess, at a proper rate, so they never get depleted.
Exactly, yeah. That's why, like, in the modern day, we're headed towards a future in which the arable land is rapidly running out, not only because of climate change, but because of farming practices. But
cash crops,
baby. Gotta get that money.
Well, we did it to ourselves, fucking let alone all the colonies we had. The Dust Bowl in the Midwest, where we just constant dust storms for 10 years and the economy crashed.
Yeah.
We ruined the soil.
But yeah, the first, like, U.S. appointed governor of Puerto Rico was Charles Allen, who was the head of the Domino Sugar Company, which is just insane. And, like,
can you say Banana Republic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 45% of all arable land was owned by U.S. companies, and 80% of that land was dedicated to sugar production. So immediately when the Americans took over, they turned Puerto Rico into another sugar colony, kind of similar to Cuba in a sense.
Exactly, yeah. That's pretty much what they did from the very beginning. And that was a big, very big consequence. And I'm looking it up. But yeah, I have it right here. Yeah, he put them as the auditor of the entire island. And they had Allen and the interests of the banks in the United States had converted like 45% of all arable land in Puerto Rico into sugar plantations. Yeah. So yeah, it's like almost the entire island was converted into a sugar colony. Another consequence, I think this is the biggest one, because it ties into another question, which is like, how did the independence movement look at Puerto Rico? And I'm getting ahead of myself a bit, but I'm gonna mention this one, is that the United States, obviously, unlike Spain, had this idea, and it's mentioned in a lot of what they're wording. The Americans considered Puerto Rico to be savages, they considered it to be uncultured, they considered us to literally be people without a god and stuff like that, even though Catholicism was the biggest religion here. Basically, they considered us uncivilized. And one of the biggest processes that occurred on the island was the Americanization of Puerto Rico. So they tried, and that was the biggest consequence of it all, because that one initiated a lot of backlash from the people. And it's basically like this. What they tried to do, the first thing they did, was they were going to give us education. And one of the things they were going to do is educate us in their ways. So what they would do is, despite the population speaking Spanish, they began to teach classes and school in English. And if you spoke Spanish, much like what they did to the natives in their own territories, where they would set up these schools, and the what was the name? It was the I forgot the name of the where they would kidnap native children and take them to school and basically raise their whole culture. Well, basically, what happened over there happened here. Basically, we were taught in English. We couldn't speak Spanish, and we spoke Spanish. We were punished. We had to sing the United States anthem every single morning. They also had to pledge allegiance to the flag. Despite the fact that we were American subjects, we weren't even citizens. So it's like they wanted to convert the entire population into Americans. They did this through education. They did this through religion. They brought, and it's one of the big, it's also a bad consequence because a lot of the island was Catholic. And they brought the evangelical and Protestant movement here to the island. And they tried to convert Puerto Ricans. And the only reason there's now a big like evangelical movement that's even it has seeped its way into the political system of today is because of that, because of the United States, because evangelicals didn't exist in the island, but they brought it over. So they tried through religion, education. They also tried through infrastructure because they would build a lot of stuff. And while it was good, it wasn't with the intention of, like, you know, helping the population. They were trying to develop a colony where the people would work in U.S. Factories making products for the United States. They weren't giving these things to help us. So, in other words, the biggest consequence of it all is that this began the process of, like, transforming Puerto Rico into the United States colony that it is, a colony that was heavily dependent on the United States, where everything, for where we import more from them than we export to them, where our population has been convinced that we are dependent on them and that without them we are nothing, and the United States is the best country on earth, and that we need to love it, and we need to pledge allegiance to the flag, and all of that. That's now, because back then there was backlash against the English and all that stuff. Like, there was a backlash on the cultural level, which would fuel the independence movement of the era. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the last consequence I can think of. There are probably more, but it's the biggest one because it's the one that would define, like, the independence movement later down the line.
Okay. So I think now we're going to start wrapping up and giving our final thoughts. We'll let you go first, Pedro, since you're our wonderful guest.
Okay. Well, first off, thanks for having me. I think this is a good episode because I think more people need to know about Puerto Rico. Like I said in the beginning, we are not mentioned that much, and I think more people need to talk about it. The same way, and I'm not trying to compare or say one is better than the other one, but the same way we talk about Palestine, we need to talk about Puerto Rico and other places because. Well, we need to understand that being a colonized people is not good. Being under the United States is not good. Whether we are not in the same conditions and living in the same situation as, for example, Palestine, we are living also a situation where we are actively being underdeveloped. But again, it's important that we understand the Puerto Rican independence struggle, that we learn about it, maybe read about it as well, because that way we understand. We need to understand other people's history in order to, you know, relate to them, bring solidarity. Because if we don't do that, we end up being like the average American liberal that will support statehood and won't question why the fuck is there a U.S. colony with over 3 million yeah. people. So, yeah, it's very important that we learn about every single oppressed people and learn their struggle.
Exactly. I really big agree on that. It's not only an exercise in empathy to learn about history and to become familiar with the conditions in which other people are living, but it's also an act of personal development, because if you can look around the world and you can see the struggles against in the American context what your own country is doing, then you can start getting an idea of how to properly go about fighting against what your country is doing at home and fighting against what your country is doing abroad. You can work to change it from within. And I think it's one of those things where everybody should do their best to learn about what is going on outside of their own state, outside of their own country, outside of their own door. Because there are billions of human beings who have hopes and dreams like you do. And there are things standing in the way of those people's achieving, not self-actualization, because that's a very like psychological term, but those people's achieving an independent and equitable society for themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about solidarity, and it's about, you know, understanding each other. That's the way we win. Yeah. Hearts and minds.
Yeah, no matter which stage you are in your colonial occupation, the struggle for freedom never ends.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So yeah, free Puerto Rico, and as always, free Palestine. And we're gonna head out now. See you guys later. Goodbye.
And as always,
No! You're not allowed to say that.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.